though I am one of our more aggressive ex-debaters and don't necessarily believe in weaning the ventilator before pulling the tube out.
Welcome back to PedeScript. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow at UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow in Washington, D.C.
So Alice, will you remind our listeners what we do here at PedeScript?
Absolutely. PedeScript is an educational podcast. We interview experts around the country and around the world to tell us about their favorite PICU and sometimes PEDS cardiac ICU teaching pearls. Zach, who are we talking to today?
So today we have the pleasure to speak with Dr. Laura Ortman. Dr. Ortman is an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Nebraska College of Medicine. She serves as the medical director of the Cardiovascular Intensive Care Unit at Children's Hospital and Medical Center in Omaha, Nebraska. She's a CPR researcher and great medical educator. She is a host on the Healing Hearts podcast that we'll share in our description. She has an ongoing cardiac lesion series, where she talks about the basics of the fundamentals of different cardiac malformations. She also produces really good short medical education videos on YouTube. You can find her at Dr. Ortman, CICU.
Yes. Today, we're going to be talking about tetralogy of Fallot. Not tetralogy of Fallot with pulmonary atresia, but really the pink tets, the blue tets, and what you can expect after their repair.
That's right. It's a bread and butter topic for our learners in the cardiac ICU. You'll see one of these likely every time you rotate through. I know I learned so much, and I think you will as well. Welcome back to PedeScript. I'm Zach Hodges. We are so excited to have Dr. Laura Ortman with us today. Laura, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Zach. Thank you, Alice. I'm really excited to be here today.
We're excited to have you.
To get things started, will you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and maybe include something you enjoy outside of medicine?
Yeah, so I'm a cardiac intensivist in Omaha, Nebraska. I decided to become a cardiac intensivist during my fourth year of medical school when I took care of a PICU patient who had cord triatriatum. And the physiology was so cool and so interesting that that's what I decided to do with my life. And I have loved every minute of it. Outside of work, anything that's outside. We don't get to see the sun much in the ICU, honestly. So if I can get outside of the building, I'm happy.
That's lovely. So we think that your Healing Hearts podcast is one of the most useful CICU resources for early learners as you really get down to the basics. Can you tell us about it and why you decided to get started with this project?
To be honest, I had never listened to a podcast prior to recording my first episode for Healing Hearts.
Really?
I had no idea. So it wasn't my idea. I got to give credit to one of our PICU nurse educators, Maddie Quinn, who had seen me at a lecture. I love giving whiteboard talks. A whiteboard and a marker, that's how I've always liked to teach. And she approached me and said, you know, the nurses would really love this, but they're not here all the time. What can we do to reach them on their level? So she suggested the podcast, and that's how this all started. And I have to give her credit for it, because she really runs that show.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
And it's the same for fellows. We're all on different schedules, taking call. And I've really found that I really enjoy podcasts like this, and I sure hope that many others do as well. So Laura, you and several others in the pediatric ICU community have been contributing to various forms of open access education for several years. How do you think moving forward, clinician educators can potentially leverage a platform like podcasts, YouTube videos, whatnot, for professional development, maybe more than just a hobby?
Yeah, so I'm going to age myself a little bit here. So during my medical training, before smartphones, before podcasts, before YouTube, and medical education was really in lecture halls or with $300 textbooks. There was a lot of gatekeeping for knowledge, and on both ways, both being able to give it to others and to be able to get it. So the revolution that has happened with open access education, I think, is fabulous for everybody involved. It's good for people outside of academic medical centers to be able to learn for continuing education, for continuing development. And it's great for people like me, who I can only reach so many people with a whiteboard and a marker. So being able to get information out there to reach fellows, nurses, students, and even the lay public is absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, for sure. So let's go and jump into our topic for the day, tetralogy of Fallot with pulmonary stenosis. Alice, do you want to bring us in our case and give us our first question?
Sure. So you've got a 3-month-old, previously healthy, full-term male with tetralogy of Fallot with pulmonary stenosis. He's scheduled for complete repair. His course thus far has been mostly uncomplicated, but he just required a short NICU stay and then has been closely followed as an outpatient. So we know that tetralogy involves pulmonary stenosis, overriding aorta, a ventricular septal defect, and right ventricular hypertrophy. But how do we connect all of these lesions? Why are these four things so closely related?
So these four defects are all really caused by a common embryologic error, and that's the faulty development of the conal septum, so the separation of the pulmonary artery and the aorta, which is part of the development of the right and left outflow tracts. It starts with malalignment of the septum, which then results in the VSD because it can't close properly in the overriding aorta. Because of this, the pulmonary outflow tract gets crowded out, therefore you get pulmonary stenosis. And then lastly, because of the pulmonary stenosis, we get right ventricular hypertrophy as the RV tries to overcome the stenosis and pump blood to the lungs.
Yeah, I feel like that intuitively makes sense. If the outflow tract for the right ventricle and left ventricle are shifted towards the right, you can see how that would restrict blood flow to the pulmonary artery, would cause that pulmonary stenosis murmur that we hear in that compensatory right ventricular hypertrophy. And also, you can see the malalignment with the VSD. What's the difference, though, in those really sick, you know, blue TET babies that we don't let go home from the nursery versus those more pink TET babies that we just come in as an outpatient for the repair?
It all comes down to the degree of pulmonary stenosis. If there's very little stenosis, there will mostly be left to right flow across the VSD, and the patient will have normal saturations in the 90s. Increased pulmonary stenosis, those severe cyanotic neonates, have increased right to left shunting across the VSD, causing the cyanosis.
So if I understand correctly, it's all about the right ventricular outflow tract obstruction. Is that right?
Yep. It's all about what's the easiest path for the blood to flow out of the heart. And if there's increased pulmonary stenosis, it's going to be across the VSD and out to the body.
Can I tell a short clinical story and try and put this in framework for you guys?
Oh, please do.
All right. So very early in my training, just so long ago, very early in my training, I came in the morning and we had just accepted a TET from the NICU. And it was like 3 week old, X36 weaker, billed as a pink TET. And I go to the bedside before I look at the echo report. And the nurse is like, the NICU nurse said there was some non-sustained desats in the 70s, just, you know, here and there, no big deal. I was like, okay. And then I talked to the patient's mother. And this baby does also have trisomy. And the patient's mom is like, the breastfeeding's not going well because they are getting tired. They're just getting so tired they can't finish the feed. So I walk back to the team room and I talk to the cards fellow. And the cards fellow is like, those things do not coexist. You're not in heart failure and having trouble eating and having non-sustained desats. Like, which is it? Hearing that story, how would you go about determining, like, okay, wait, pink TET or blue TET?
Well, saying those things can't exist together is suggesting that the physiology of the baby never changes, depending on what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true. So a baby who is sitting there quiet, sleeping, may have very little obstruction to right ventricular outflow tracts. It's not just the valve. It's also the muscle under the valve. So in that case, the baby may have increased left to right flow across the VSD and look more like a VSD with heart failure. But the baby gets upset. The baby's working really hard to eat. The baby's crying. You have increased obstruction temporarily to right ventricular outflow. And so you're going to get desaturations, which will be temporary. So you can't have both.
Thank you.
I think what's so fascinating and so difficult about cardiac ICU is just how much our patient's physiology changes those first few days.
There's so much physiology in the cardiac ICU.
Yeah.
That's what makes it awesome.
That's right. When I was preparing for this talk, there was almost a dichotomous conversation going on if a patient has tetralogy of fluid pulmonary stenosis versus pulmonary atresia. How should we think about tetralogy with pulmonary atresia differently?
Tetralogy of pulmonary atresia really is a different disease. And there's no outflow from the heart to the lungs, which requires always surgery in the neonatal timeframe. It's really a different beast entirely.
Sure. So the rest of our conversation today, we'll just focus on tetralogy with pulmonary stenosis.
Yes.
So what exactly are the surgical options for a patient with tetralogy with pulmonary stenosis? Do all patients get repaired first line, or is there typically maybe a palliative procedure first?
There's a couple of different options depending on how cyanotic the patient is. So if you have a neonate who is too cyanotic to go home, and too cyanotic is a little bit relative, but if their sats are in the 70s or lower, that baby needs something done before they can leave the hospital. What gets done in those circumstances is surgeon dependent and dependent on what institution you're at. So some patients may undergo a complete repair as a neonate. So complete repair being opening up the RV outflow tract and closing the VSD. Other patients may choose to undergo a palliative procedure to get more pulmonary blood flow, but keeping the VSD open and then come back later for complete repair. If the baby has other comorbidities, if they are premature, if they have significant lung disease, if they've got other neonatal issues, a palliative option is probably the better option for that baby.
Just do something a little bit more stepwise if they couldn't really tolerate the post-op recovery, maybe.
Yeah, because a neonate getting a complete repair, they have more complications, they have longer post-operative stays. We know this. And a complete repair does involve a cardiopulmonary bypass run. And there are concerns about bypass and neonatal brains. So doing a palliative repair avoids a bypass. It's a much easier surgery. But the baby's going to have to come back later for a complete repair. So it's always two procedures.
Do you mind for me painting a picture of a really sick neonate who would almost always get a palliative procedure versus a well infant that would almost certainly always get a complete repair? Just for learning.
So some of it's the degree of cyanosis. So if I have a small baby with SATs in the 60s because of decreased pulmonary blood flow, they're going to need something in the immediate newborn period. And again, size matters when it comes to postoperative complications. So if I have a small baby, a palliative one's going to look much more, I'm searching for the word
appealing
I'm
to a surgeon.
For. Much more appealing, yes.
In my general pediatric residency, something that I used to hear is the dogma of once they start spelling, it's time for scheduling the repair like tomorrow. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. So hypercyanotic spells are temporary spells where there's significant constriction of the right ventricular outflow tract. So these babies will come in with a history of my baby was crying and they suddenly became deeply cyanotic. SATs in the 20s, SATs in the 30s. That's, in a sense, a medical emergency because we know from experience that that is a patient that is risk for death. So when we start getting that story that they're having these spells, it's time to repair them.
No, thank you.
Say it's been determined that a patient should proceed with a palliative procedure. What options are there generally, and when is this typically done?
There is a couple different options. So the most common is a arterial to pulmonary shunt, such as a BTT shunt, because the goal really of a palliative procedure is just to get enough pulmonary blood flow to buy you some time. In a severely cyanotic infant, this may be in the first couple of days of life, certainly before they go home if you're concerned they can't safely go home. Other options besides a shunt that involve using the cath lab instead of going to the OR, if it's purely a valve problem, there's a potential for pulmonary valvotomy in the cath lab, opening that up. Unfortunately, there's often a lot of RV muscle underneath the valve that would prevent that from being helpful. In that case, option that's becoming more common is stenting the RVOT. So placing a stent in the cath lab across both the muscle bundles and the valve to stent that open.
Sure. Is a PDA stent used in this pathology or no?
It can be. And that would be, a fourth option as well. If you've got an open PDA, stenting that to get more pulmonary blood flow.
So let's say you have a patient who maybe is not a cyanotic, maybe a larger birth weight, is coming back in for complete repair. When is that typically done? Is that something done earlier in life, like 2 to 3 months or a little bit later?
So it depends a little bit if they're symptomatic. So we already talked about hypercyanotic spells, TET spells. Well, that would be a trigger that they need to come in now, regardless of age. If the patient is developing worsening cyanosis, that would also be a trigger. The natural history of TET is for the RVOT obstruction to worsen over time. So before we had heart surgery as an option, these patients would become increasingly cyanotic and eventually die of either cyanosis or RV failure. If the patient has a pink TET, if they are not having symptoms, we know that the bigger they are, the less postoperative complications they're going to have. But we also know if we wait too long, that RV begins to suffer as it struggles against the pulmonary stenosis. So general recommendations is sometime between 3 months and 1 year of age.
Sure. And just letting the patient's physiology direct that, whether it's sooner or later, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely a wide range.
So let's say your patient with tetralogy is going for full repair, just like our case today. What are the goals for that operation and how practically is that done in the operating room?
Well, the number one goal is to create unobstructed pulmonary blood flow. Closing the VSD is important as well, but really creating that open RVOT is the biggest part of the operation. There's two ways this is done, and it's really dependent on how much obstruction there is preoperatively. The first is a surgical valvotomy, where the surgeon is able to open up the valve and then remove any muscle bundles below the valve to open it up. That's called a valve-sparing repair, and about half of patients can have that done. However, if the valve annulus itself is too tight, too small, that even if the surgeon opens it up, there will still be obstruction. This option for that is called a transannular patch. So this is where the ring around the valve, the annulus itself, is split open, and then patched across to create a open RVOT.
And by echo, would they know going to the operation, you know, this patient's valve annulus is too small, doing a valve sparing approach is not even an option? Would they know that going in or no?
The surgeons usually have a good idea, but most commonly they measure the annulus in the operating room to make that determination. If it's borderline, they may try the valvotomy, take them off bypass, and then do an echocardiogram and see what kind of obstruction is left behind.
Nice. So this kid, you're not really sure if they're going to be able to do a valve sparing repair. They go to the OR. When they come back, besides the involvement of the valve in the repair, what key information do we need to elicit at surgical sign-out?
Well, besides the valve repair, that's actually probably the most important thing. That's the number one thing. Not because the surgical technique matters to us that much in the CICU, but it tells me something about how much obstruction there has been preoperatively, which tells me how bad of a post-op night I'm going to have. The more obstruction there was, so meaning they need a transannular patch, or the more cyanotic they were preoperatively, tells me that I likely have more post-operative RV dysfunction that first post-operative night. So that's really important for me to know. The second thing I really want to know is there an open ASD? And this is also a little bit surgeon dependent. They may purposely do that. Because if there's an open ASD and I have RV dysfunction postoperatively, I'm going to get right to left shunting across that ASD, which is perfectly fine. That's actually good because it can help maintain my cardiac output, but it will change what I make my saturation goals.
Sure, and that makes sense.
Nice.
Before we move completely to the postoperative management, when I was reading about the actual surgery, I read about possibly some surgeons using a ventricular incision to facilitate repair. Why might they want to do that, and what are the benefits and risks of that?
So the obstruction to outflow in tetralogy can be at multiple levels. Certainly, we've talked about the valve a lot. It can also be supervalvular, so the main PA can be small, as well as the muscle under the valve. And sometimes they're unable to open that up enough just by removing muscle bundles. And that's why it requires potential ventriculotomy and opening up of the outflow tract that way.
Okay, that makes intuitive sense.
And that sounds like it would change your postoperative concerns pretty significantly. Is that the case?
Anytime there's cut into the ventricular muscle, I always worry about ventricular dysfunction. There's also a potential risk for inciting arrhythmias when you have a scar across ventricular muscle.
And there's also coronary concerns with patients with tetralogy, correct? What should we know about those?
Yeah, tetralogies can have abnormal origins of their coronaries. And that's not something that we talked about when we talked about potential reasons for palliative procedures being necessary. But it does occur where the coronaries can lie across the RVOT and be positioned in a way that it can make it very difficult for the surgeon to fully open that up, especially when they're neonates. So that would be another patient that they would potentially do a palliative procedure early on, wait till they're bigger so that it's easier to get around those coronaries.
When we think about visualizing these structures in the best possible way pre-op, I know that there's a lot of clinical variability in the imaging necessary while you plan these procedures. Can you get what you need with just an echo?
So our echo capabilities have improved markedly since I was in training. So when I very first started off, most TETs that I dealt with got caths prior to going to the operating room. Maybe that was location dependent or surgeon dependent. I worked with an older surgeon, but he really wanted that information as clear as possible. I feel like our echo tech is improved markedly in the last 20 years. So most of the time we can get those images. Occasionally a patient will require a CT. There's really no reason for a TET these days to require a cath unless there's other concerns. If we can't see what we need with echo, a cardiac CT should tell us just fine.
So I want to set the scene for you. You're coming on, you're on call tonight in the cardiac ICU. The tetralogy patient just came back maybe an hour before handover. So they're just getting them settled as you get there to get sign out. What is the short list, maybe 3-4 complications that's on your mind that you want to look out for tonight? And how do you plan to monitor that patient to detect them?
The most common complication after TET repair is RV diastolic dysfunction, which leads to low cardiac output and hypotension. Generally, these babies don't have much problem with systolic dysfunction. Their myocardium squeezes just fine. It just doesn't relax, especially on the right side. So I know this hypertrophic RV is potentially going to be stiff. It's going to require higher CVP. It's going to require potentially fluid boluses that first night. So knowing what the CVP coming out of the OR can be very helpful. Because if anesthesia tells you that the patient needed a CVP of 14 in order to maintain a good blood pressure in the OR, I know that's actually going to get worse over time, especially that first night before the RV starts relaxing again. The second big complication I'm worried about in this patient is arrhythmias. There's a VSD closure. There is carving out of muscle under the RVOT. This all puts it very close to the AV node, which can predispose a patient to junctional ectopic tachycardia as well as heart block.
Your description of RV diastolic dysfunction really gives color to the adage, water your tets, that we sometimes say.
Sometimes they can require a lot of fluid that first night.
And then is there any typical vasoactive that you would always have on a patient with tetralogy, or is it somewhat variable?
Unfortunately, since the problem is diastolic dysfunction, vasoactives may not be very useful. There's this old thought that milrinone can relax myocardium. So often they're on milrinone. I'm not honestly sure how often that's helpful. Other vasopressors, such as vasopressin, epinephrine, they really don't help diastolic dysfunction. And since the systolic function is fine, you may not get much bang for your buck with those.
But sure, just keeping a generous CVP so you can just essentially push volume into the RV is probably what I have in mind, right?
Absolutely. It's all about RV preload.
So you mentioned a risk for arrhythmias, and you recalled that jet was a potential concern. What exactly is jet, and how do you detect it? Like, how do you say it's jet versus some other supraventricular arrhythmia?
So junctional ectopic tachycardia is an automatic tachycardia that originates from the AV node. This means that the AV node is irritated from the surgery and firing at a rate faster than the sinus node. This presents as a narrow complex tachyarrhythmia. The rates are usually between 160 and 220. If it's a lot higher than that, I'm more likely to think of a reentrant SVT. As far as diagnosis, it can look like a lot of other things as well, but the biggest thing is that there isn't a P wave in front of every QRS. That can be really hard to see at high rates, and that's where doing an atrial EKG can be incredibly helpful to help you determine where that P wave is. In jet, the P wave may be absent entirely. It may be present but going at a slower rate than the jet rate, or it may be retrograde. So for every QRS, you have a P wave directly behind it. And that's really pathognomonic for jet.
I feel like our attendings are always asking us questions about the CVP when we have a patient with jet. What should I know about that?
So the interesting thing about jet is that the atrium and the ventricle are not contracting together. So the ventricle is doing its thing, determined by the rate of the AV node, the jet. The atrium are doing their thing, and they're not talking to each other. So what happens is you'll have the atrium contracting and hitting against a closed AV valve. This causes a spike in your CVP waveform, which we call a Cannon A wave, which again is very classic for jet.
Yes. And the reason that you can detect jet from outside of the room sometimes, or suspect it, right? Because you could see the CVP going like this before you see anything else.
Absolutely. There's not a lot of other arrhythmias that do this.
So you have that patient come back with tetralogy and you're worried about an arrhythmia. You see on the monitor, you see the CVP tracing is consistent with jet. What do you do? What is your practical bedside approach?
Well, unlike other arrhythmias like a reentrant SVT, rapid atrial pacing doesn't work to break them out of it. Shocking doesn't work. Adenosine doesn't work. Now, if I'm really not sure it's jet, I might use one of those modalities, probably the pacemaker with rapid atrial pacing, to see if I can get them out of it. And if I can't, that again tells me this is most likely jet. Jet, being an automatic tachycardia, is very sensitive to catecholamines. So both intrinsic catecholamines for the patient as well as extrinsic catecholamines that we give the patient. So if they are on epinephrine and if I can decrease that, that will help potentially lower my jet rate. If the patient is agitated and they're making their own intrinsic catecholamines, calming them down can help. So making sure the patient is sedated. Temperature also matters. So if they have a fever, getting them down to low normal temperature can slow that jet rate down. Now, I can't convert them out of it. Jet is self-limiting. It will go away on its own within 2 to 3 days. My goal in treatment isn't to convert them out of jet. I'll be wasting my time if I try to do that. It's impossible. My goal is to lower that jet rate so I can pace above it. Now, it's not the rate that makes patients unstable with jet. A heart rate of 160, 170 in a postoperative baby shouldn't cause harm. They may not love it, but they won't be terribly unstable. It's the lack of AV synchrony in the immediate postoperative period, especially in this case where I have a patient that has a really stiff RV. That atrial kick may be really important to their cardiac output, and that's gone with jet. So I want to get their jet rate down so that I can AV pace above, restore AV synchrony, and improve my cardiac output that way. Amiodarone is currently the drug of choice, but there are other options other institutions use, such as sotalol or procainamide.
I feel like I've heard people talk about using dexmedetomidine. Do you use that in your practice?
Yeah. So there's actually a lot of papers on using dex for jet. I wrote one of them, if you want to go look that up.
Mm-hmm. In the show notes.
All of our patients in my institution come out on dexmedetomidine. That's our standard sedative. And there's some evidence that dex started early can potentially prevent the development of jet. It's less clear that after jet starts how helpful dex is. A common side effect of dex is lowering the heart rate. It will do that in anybody. So it makes sense, theoretically, that it could lower the jet rate as well. So even though the evidence isn't entirely 100% clear on our jet treatment protocol, increasing the dexmedetomidine is part of the treatment plan.
It makes sense to sort of block a little bit of the sympathetic stimulation to the heart, right?
Yeah, and I want them a little bit more sedated anyway, and increasing the dex will help with that.
My favorite sedative, totally. So now it's post-op night one. What are your goals for this patient? What can you expect and what means that the night has gone well?
It's all about how much fluid you have to give. I have to maintain preload to the RV, but I know the more fluid I give, the more that's going to go in the lungs in the form of pulmonary edema and the harder it is to get that patient off the ventilator in the long run. So it's really about balancing the fluid I'm giving to maintain the cardiac output I need, but not overdoing it.
Nice. Do you like to start diuresis on post-op night one?
Not on tetralogies.
Okay.
So we know this patient's going to require preload to the RV in order to get cardiac output. So just let them get the preload. Even if you're not giving the fluid boluses, trying to take it away too early in tetralogy can be detrimental to your cardiac output. And while most of my patients, I'm able to start diuretics on post-op day one, tetralogies are the one that sometimes takes a little bit longer. It takes several days for that RV to finally start relaxing with the new physiology that it has. And so I may not be able to start taking fluid off for several days after surgery.
And other than titrating just the right amount of fluids, is there any other therapies that you always initiate on first post-op night or any other goals that you might have?
Anything else that could potentially relax the pulmonary vascular bed can be helpful. Patients in tetralogy are not at risk for postoperative pulmonary hypertension. They have no substrate for that preoperatively. However, all patients get a little bit increased PVR with cardiopulmonary bypass. So anything that I can do to help the RV is going to be helpful. So giving them a bit extra oxygen than you would normally do, keeping the ventilator settings as low as possible, and extubating sooner than you think you might otherwise. So positive pressure ventilation decreases preload to the RV. It also increases afterload to the RV. And we know that the RV is unhappy. So getting that patient extubated as soon as possible, and maybe a little bit sooner than you think reasonable, based on their hemodynamics and their ventilator settings, may actually help you.
So let's go ahead and go into that. When would you really like to try to extubate a post-op tetralogy? And you mentioned already that maybe their hemodynamics aren't perfect. So this might mean extubating when you've been giving some fluid boluses and or maybe a little bit of vasoactives. What does this look like in practice?
Ideally, if the patient's out of the neonatal period, I'd love it if they were extubated when they showed up in my ICU. So extubation in the OR is great, especially for this patient population. Neonates are a little more challenging with their smaller bodies and their sensitivity to fluid, so I expect they're going to be intubated when they show up. My hope is to get them extubated within post-op day one or two. So even if I haven't started diuresis yet, even if I do have them a little vasopressors because I have to maintain their blood pressures, even if I've given them some fluid in the last 6 hours, it's really worth considering extubation.
How dramatic is the change in physiology after you extubate these patients? Do you find that their right ventricles become better functioning or more compliant? I mean, what do you look for at the bedside to see, you know, this extubation was successful?
My hope is that they'll require a lower CVP in order to maintain cardiac output. So maybe I'll have to give them less fluid in order to get the cardiac output that I want. Their blood pressure should be better. We should be getting more flow through the RV because it's all about the RV. The LV really doesn't care about a tet repair. It's fine. But it's all about maintaining my preload and reducing afterload as much as I can.
Can you comment on what type of vent settings you'll be using if you're unable to extubate the patient to minimize your RV afterload?
The lowest PEEP you can manage is important. That can be hard if you've got a lot of pulmonary edema, if you've got sick lungs. Sick lungs after a tet repair is a pain. And again, it's a whole lot of physiology that you're having to deal with there. the lowest peak inspiratory pressures you can. So that may be smaller tidal volumes as well.
In a textbook I read, and have you mentioned like APRV? And I just can't imagine that's very common. Is that something you guys have used for these patients?
We do, and we literally had a discussion about this yesterday about Fontans and APRV.
Interesting.
So APRV is an interesting mode of ventilation that's largely used for ARDS because it allows maintaining a higher mean airway pressure, but with a lower peak inspiratory pressure. Also with the airway releases, you drop the PEEP down to zero briefly. That is thought in tetralogy is a really good example, as well as Glenn and Fontans, to improve venous return to the heart. And that's really what you're looking for in these patients.
That's so fascinating.
Because of the T-low at the zero PEEP or because of the sustained slightly lower pressure?
It's a little bit of both. The PEEP is zero, the T-low, as well as the lower overall mean airway pressure.
And these patients are always spontaneously breathing. So in theory, negative inspiratory pressure in the chest, hopefully they're increasing their venous return.
Absolutely.
Wow. And just out of curiosity, what kind of PHIs might you typically use for a patient like this?
Try to aim, again, as low as possible, as you can get away with.
Sure.
I usually find myself sitting in the high teens, so somewhere between 16 and 18 to start with.
And that sounds like, in my mind, rare, although it should not be rare, is my understanding, occurrence of, we are now extubating this baby on APRV.
It's not common, though I am one of our more aggressive extubators and don't necessarily believe in weaning the ventilator before pulling the tube out.
Oh, so fun. I guess to round off APRV question, what kind of T-high versus T-low do you typically would you start off these patients?
I usually start around 3.5 to 4 for my T-high and just look at my CO2s and see how that's working.
Nice.
That's so fun.
I am not sure if this is something that I personally will be able to try as a fellow in our unit, but I would be very excited to see it work.
Well, I didn't learn anything about APRV in training because my attendings did not believe it. However, we had a burn unit that was run by surgeons in my hospital, and they used it all the time in their ARDS burn patients. And so I went down there and had them tell me about it. It's an uncommon mode of ventilation, but it's definitely interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, I was really surprised by that question because like in a post-op TET APRV, but you've convinced me. It sounds like it makes a lot of sense, especially with the negative intrathoracic pressure the baby generates maybe. So,
yeah, the physiology makes perfect sense of why this patient might like that.
And I think I found my favorite soundbite of our podcast thus far. I don't believe in weaning the vent before I pull the tube.
No, Dr. Ortman never weans a vent.
That's right. Rounds tomorrow. That's what I'm telling my attending. I don't care about weaning. No.
You're going to be like, Zach, this patient has bronchiolitis.
Zach, you've been podcasting too much, I think.
They're either ready or they're not.
That's exactly right.
When they're ready, pull the tube out. Don't waste your time.
That's perfect.
In the CICU.
Very practical, yes. So we talked about the main barrier to discharge, that being extubation. What are the other barriers to discharge that we should really have on our forefront of our mind for these kids in the cardiac ICU?
So a lot of it has to do with how much fluid you put on, because that all has to come out before they can go. Feeding intolerance after TET repair is a thing that can happen. If you think about it, if they have a really stiff RV and that worsens after repair, that can cause venous congestion down the IVC into the gut veins, which can result in feeding intolerance. There's an interesting phenomenon as well with late diastolic dysfunction. It doesn't happen often, but I've seen it in that 4 to 5 day period after repair. The patient did really well after the repair, extubated, maybe even transferred to the floor, and then has this late onset of severe RV dysfunction. It's again temporary. I don't really have a good explanation for it. But that can delay discharge as well.
Oh, interesting. I'm a little embarrassed to admit that when my kids in the CI have feed intolerance, I'm not thinking about venous congestion. I'm just thinking, oh, another kid with feeding intolerance. So I appreciate that framework.
Yeah, feeding intolerance is so common in the CICU, and it can be really hard to tell what the actual problem is. Sometimes the problem's us. We don't tolerate baby spitting up, and babies spit up a lot, even when they're healthy. But it can be a sign of heart failure. It can be a sign of RV dysfunction. And we have to think about those things.
So generally speaking, when do you expect a post-op tetralogy patient to be able to leave the cardiac ICU, maybe to a step down or a regular cardiac ward?
If it's a pink TET that's coming in later in infancy, I would like them out of my ICU on post-op day one. If they're extubated in the OR, they're moving along, hopefully they're eating a little bit something, they should be ready to go. For younger babies, we're looking at several days. To get them extubated, to get the fluid off, I like to see that they are eating a little bit before they go. So we're looking more in the 5 to 7 day range for our younger tets.
Nice. And then as these kids go home or approach hospital discharge, start to get older, are there intermediate and long-term complications that we need to specifically be keeping an eye out for?
Absolutely. So if a pink tet is repaired late in infancy with a valve-sparing operation, there's a chance that they will have no residual problems long-term and we'll never see them again. The issue with the cyanotic tets, the blue tets, and those that have required a transannular patch is that patch, that area, doesn't necessarily grow well with time. It also results in free pulmonary insufficiency. If you open up the annulus, there's no way for that valve to close entirely. So the patient will come out of the operating room with free PI. This is well tolerated in the short term, but in the long term, that pulmonary insufficiency will result in RV dilation and eventually RV dysfunction and potentially RV failure if it's not dealt with. So patients with a transannular patch will generally always have a reoperation, often sometimes in childhood. We want to get them out as far as possible, so we may not see them until their middle school or even teenage years, but they're going to be back.
And would they likely be looking at like a catheter-based approach to replace that pulmonary valve or something else?
Generally not. So there's new pulmonary valves that can be placed in the cath lab that have come out within the last few years, which I think are a game changer for a lot of people and can prevent surgeries. But those require a certain size of an RVOT in order to place them. So if the patient is coming back in early childhood, they're most likely to need an RV to PA conduit first. That's another reason for them to get out as far as possible from their first surgery before we do that. The larger the conduit we can put in, the more likely that next time they need that fixed, which again is going to happen, they can have something done in the cath lab instead of another operation.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we've had a great conversation today about a bread and butter topic in the cardiac ICU, tetralogy of flow pulmonary stenosis, something that we're going to see nearly every time we rotate through. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention or cover today before we wrap things up?
Now, tetralogy flow is one of the most common cardiac defects, and it's something you're going to see a lot in the ICU. So it's really important to have a good understanding of the physiology because it's different than any of our other surgeries. It's also really cool because it's one of the first defects that anybody tried to repair back in the 1940s. And that's a really interesting story about the development of the BTT shunt and how that was done for tetralogy. And if you haven't seen that before, that's something y'all need to look up because it's absolutely fascinating and an important part of the history of our field because nobody touched heart disease before that. And it was really groundbreaking, the work that was done. But I think it's really cool because it really makes us think about the physiology.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, Dr. Laura Ortman, we thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. We're so excited to get this episode edited up and out to our listeners. I know I've learned a lot today, and I know they will as well.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @critpeds and @pedscrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.